Welcome to Primetime.
This week, The Duke of Newcastle, Part 2, or a second episode for examining Thomas Pelham Hommes, first Duke of Newcastle upon Tyne, and for connected purposes.
Hello, and welcome to Primetime. We're ranking all the British Prime Ministers from Robert Walpole to the modern day. I'm John.
I'm Rob.
And I'm Cass, and today we're taking a second look at our fifth Prime Minister, also known as Hubble Bubble. I think I might know why he's called Hubble Bubble.
Oh, I completely forgot to research that.
That's really helpful.
So, definition of Hubble bubble, noun, as in commotion, a state of noisy, confused activity.
Oh, sort of like a hubbub.
I.e. commotion, disturbance, racket, hurry, scurry, hurly-burly.
We're saying that he's a sort of dramatic, you know, all over the place kind of character.
Eruption.
Not yeah. achieving much. But...
Well, you said that Henry was quite calm, and unlike Henry, Thomas was known to be like quick to... anger and emotion, right? So that kind of makes sense, I guess.
Yeah, so there are a lot of stories about how he was just a bit over the top and quite a ridiculous figure. And I think a lot of people also hammed up those stories because they quite like to tell ridiculous stories about him.
Did Horace Walpole ham up these stories?
No, he would never. No,
potentially, no. But there is a fun story about Newcastle visiting Pitt the Elder, who was confined to his bed by gout.
Oh no.
The room was freezing cold because it was November and Pitt didn't have a fire. Because that made his gout worse. So Newcastle, who was apparently a hypochondriac, asked if he would mind if he just climbed into the other bed in the room. So then they yelled at each other from bed to bed.
Oh God, that's exactly what I would have done, though.
Mm. Yeah. Arguing about whether or not they should be pursuing the French.
Oh my God.
That's really Hubble Bubble, that is.
This is so funny. Okay, I think that tracks then.
Yeah,
absolutely. Speaking of things tracking... Does either one of you want to tell me what happened in our first episode?
Oh, I literally listened to it on the train home.
Nothing stuck.
Oh, he got all of the titles. I remember that. He literally got every single one of the titles.
Mm, yes.
That did happen, yes.
Lots and lots of people in his family died and they all kept leaving their stuff to him. So and he just accumulated endless dead relatives.
And the king
money.
Also like endlessly promote him or something.
Yes, yes. That also then happened.
Because
yes.
he was like a really strong Hanoverian.
Yep.
Oh. And George was like, oh, Dankeschön, have all the titles.
George Washington turned up. He created a war with the French and then Thomas resigned.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've just summarized his entire life in about 10 seconds, but you're bang on. In the middle, he and his brother supported the Prime Minister, and then his brother became Prime Minister, and then he became Prime Minister.
Yes. And at the end, he lost Menorca or something.
Oh, that's embarrassing.
Yes, he did.
Old job, Newcastle.
Newcastle resigned in 1756, having only been Prime Minister himself for about 2 years, although he'd been one of the top people in government for 35 years.
Yeah.
In fact, he had never been in opposition, really, just permanently in government at the top.
Weird.
I was going to say that's because he was a Whig, but there were opposition Whigs. But yeah, interesting.
The British leadership had bungled the outbreak of the Seven Years' War, and heads had rolled. Newcastle had been forced out. But it wasn't long before opportunity came a-knocking. You may recall that Newcastle had been incredibly frustrated because he wanted to bring William Pitt into his ministry.
Yes.
Both to manage the commons and to prosecute the war.
But because William Pitt had stolen Jenkins' ear, the king said no.
The king definitely said no. We don't know if this was because of potential possession of one of Jenkins' ears.
But I think we can guess, and the answer's probably no.
All evidence points in that direction.
Well, we'll obviously cover Pitt in more detail later, but Pitt was invited into the subsequent ministry without Newcastle, and he became its leader in all but name.
Ooh.
Oh.
So we will revisit this period, but what matters is that the king still hated Pitt. He just learned to tolerate him a little bit.
Okay.
But eventually the king realised that the way forward...
He learned to pit up with him.
Oh, no.
The king still hated Pitt, but he eventually realised that the way forward was to keep Pitt as Southern Secretary, but to put Newcastle back in the government, in charge, at least nominally, to keep Pitt under control.
Oh. Yes.
So basically, the king eventually went, all right, you can have William Pitt, fine, just come back.
Ah, and how long did this take?
I'm not going to tell you because Ooh. That's going to be the subject of a future episode.
Ooh, okay.
Because somebody else would be in charge. Yeah, yeah, so yeah. I don't want to go into too much detail.
Oh, I see.
Despite the misgivings of their contemporaries, Pitt and Newcastle turned out to be a bit of a power couple. Pitt handled the commons and the war, and Newcastle handled the lords and the money. That's loans, taxes, a lot of bribery,
yep.
or patronage, as it was called at the time.
Election expenses.
Yes. Together, they turned it around. And in 1759, there was a string of victories leading to Horace Walpole saying, "Our bells are worn threadbare with ringing for victories."
Oh, amazing.
When Horace Walpole finally dies out, can we have like a full moment of silence, like a minute of silence, just to yeah. mourn the loss of that? Because I am obsessed with him.
I mean, to be more fitting as a character, we should have like 2 minutes of bitching.
About Horace Walpole.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I love that. Our bells are threadbare. You're going to do so much winning, you're going to get tired of winning.
This year is sometimes referred to as the Annus Mirabilis.
Not the Annus Horribilis.
No. Historian Frank McLean considered this to be the point where the British Empire overtook the French and became the dominant global superpower.
Oh, I mean, that's big.
We're beating the French. That's the really important bit.
Most important.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, like all ministers at the time, Newcastle's power relied heavily on the confidence of George II, and in 1760, the 76-year-old king unfortunately died from internal bleeding. This potentially happened while he was sitting on the loo.
Oh, Elvis style!
The loo was a close stool, which is essentially a seat with a hole in it and a box underneath. So think festival toilets here.
He's in a port-a-loo.
The king of Great Britain can only get a port-a-loo.
I mean, he was 76 and he died in his home.
Yeah, okay.
George II's heir was his grandson, who was quickly crowned George III in a lavish but poorly organised 6-hour coronation service in Westminster Abbey. There was apparently an apology afterwards for how terrible it was.
Really? Oh, that must be awful.
But one thing that was well organised was that the new Queen Charlotte had sensibly arranged to have a retiring chamber set up in St Edward's Chapel. But when she visited it, she found that the Duke of Newcastle was already there, perked up and in the very act upon the anointed velvet close stool.
So during the coronation, a loo had been set up for the queen that she could just pop out to.
Yep.
And the Duke of Newcastle was on it.
In there, taking a poo. Yeah. No! The queen walked in on him doing a poo. That's so embarrassing.
That's Hubble Bubble.
And it's this exact sort of thing that just, you know, it's why he gets this reputation of being this ridiculous character.
I am obsessed with this. We are putting this fact in Life and Legacy.
He was engaging the loo that was meant for the queen.
Wow. Is this treason?
I don't think that's explicitly set out in law.
This is an incredible story.
I really like this.
The king is being crowned and both the queen and the prime minister are like fighting over a toilet.
To the death.
I need a half-time poo, come on.
Once again, I have to thank Rex Factor for this story, because they covered it in their recent episode about Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz.
I was going to ask if this was that Charlotte.
It was the beginning of the end for Newcastle.
The beginning of the end of his poo. As soon as he saw the queen, straight out.
I am so sorry. I'm going to resign.
Oh, you wouldn't. You would have to resign, wouldn't you?
It's unlikely that George hated him solely because of the state in which he left the royal retiring chamber during the coronation. But for whatever reason, the newly crowned 22-year-old king wanted to appoint some new blood to his cabinet.
Right.
He saw them, Newcastle and his mates, as the corrupt old guard.
Who had been there for decades.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And he had his own man and former tutor, the Earl of Bute, whom he insisted on appointing to the cabinet.
Right.
The king's cabinet, after all.
Yeah.
Newcastle and Pitt were incensed, but there was nothing they could really do. Worse, George began insisting that they wind down their involvement with the Seven Years' War, even though Britain were winning, and they weren't even 7 years in, so it clearly wasn't over yet. In May of 1762, George sacked Newcastle.
Wow.
Wait, he sacked him from being first?
Yep.
Wait, so this is it? This is the end of his...
This is the end.
So the timeline is, he was like rising power, he got all the stuff, he got his brother to be prime minister, he got to be prime minister, he did loads of stuff, it all went horribly wrong, he resigned, he came back into power, did a massive poo and then immediately got fired.
Then was sacked. So to be fair, I'm glossing over the 7 years war. So his first time as prime minister was actually relatively short.
Yeah.
And there are a few things we're going to talk about in prime and premiership. His second time was a bit longer, but mostly was consumed by the war, which we're going to cover a lot more in a future episode.
Yeah.
So he was at the top and he did represent stability during this period and everything, but he also represented the old guard and everything that George III wanted to sweep away, like the poo that he left behind.
Interesting. And that, I suppose that is quite interesting that, unlike some series, like the American series, for example, is very easy because there's a constitution that says there's going to be a president and then there's the first president, who you may have mentioned in this episode already, and then you can just count them very easily. Whereas ours, it's like the office develops and you have to sort of pick a beginning. We're still having quite a few prime ministers in now, the king just going, I don't want you, off you go. So the office isn't quite stabilised the way it is.
This is often considered the last time that a king, or indeed a monarch, just sacked somebody because they didn't like them.
Interesting.
It's not the last time that somebody left because the monarch didn't like them.
Right.
But it is the last time that the prime minister was actually fired by the monarch.
Interesting. Okay.
Newcastle continued to wield considerable influence and money. Mm-hmm. So he remained active in politics in the subsequent years. He even rejoined the cabinet as Lord Privy Seal in 1765.
Well, he would be Lord of the Privy, wouldn't he?
On the CV when it says, like, previous experience?
However, his health began to decline, and in 1767, he suffered a stroke, and he died a year later at the age of 75 at his home in Lincoln's Inn Fields. Mm. And now the time has come for us to review him.
Prime and Premiership.
Historian John B. Owen remarked, "Made to appear ridiculous by his strange external eccentricities, and subject always to a host of neurotic fears and jealousies, he was physically and temperamentally ill-equipped for the strenuous demands of statesmanship. But none can read his papers without being impressed by his comprehensive knowledge of foreign politics, his cogent and consistently held principles, and his ample fund of shrewd common sense."
So great on paper. Not so much in person.
Yeah. I mean,
interesting.
It sounds like he was someone who was very good at some things, but not quite an all-rounder.
Yeah.
So he really needed somebody else to rely on. And you can see that he was at his best when he had somebody, his brother, William Pitt, somebody else to sort of round him out a bit.
Ah. Interesting. And I did like the talk about foreign policy, because that was the big thing he loved during the early part of his life. He sort of jealously guarded his
Good job with foreign policy. I mean, you know, we're at war with the French, we've lost Menorca. It's all going
so well.
We've
just become the greatest empire in the world.
Oh, do you know what? Fair enough. Yeah. That's a good point well made.
We are going to have to talk about that.
Yeah.
He also said himself, "My natural love of politics and being concerned in the public world, both in town and country, will make a private life very disagreeable to me."
Oh, he's so boring, though.
So you wanted him to go to space instead of being prime minister.
Did I say that?
Yes. And I said that nobody was trying that in the 18th century. But I did remember that there is a story of a Chinese official called Wan Hu. Apologies if my pronunciation of that isn't perfect.
It wasn't.
Who tried to go to space in the 14th century by strapping 47 rockets to a chair.
Oh, no!
The rockets, the chair, and Wan Hu all disappeared.
Oh,
I don't know if this is true. It's a bit of a legend.
I'm obsessed with this. It is definitely true.
But Newcastle could have made a good go of it some 350 years later if he'd really tried.
He could have strapped them to the royal privy.
Oh, that would be amazing. So if you strap so many rockets to a chair, I get the thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to go
up. I see the gravity of that.
But when you get to the high point,
what's
the plan then?
I don't know. And to be honest, this is one of those stories that some attestations claim that it was in sort of 2000 BC before the development of writing or gunpowder.
Or chairs.
Exactly. So I think it's just a fun story rather than necessarily a historically accurate thing.
Yeah. Okay.
But it is fun to think that actually people had thought about going to space.
Yeah, that's fun.
Back to Newcastle.
No, I love the chair story.
Although he made great strides in the 7 Years' War, there are certainly accusations of short-sightedness or even negligence to be made. Newcastle had been Secretary of State for the Southern Department from 1724 until 1748, almost 24 years. Can you guess which bits of overseas the Secretary of State for the Southern Department was responsible for?
It was all of, like, Southern Europe and the Mediterranean.
Yep. Where else?
Menorca?
America.
Oh, no.
Now, he had focused all of his foreign policy efforts on securing the election of Maria Theresa's son as the King of the Romans, which is a sort of honorary position within the Holy Roman Empire. The Austrians didn't really care about this, and this was what he was basically spending all of his political capital doing while George Washington was ambushing the French.
Starting America. A massive
exactly.
transcontinental war. Mm. Okay.
So this sort of happened on his watch.
Yeah.
Now, in this period, there was a boom in colonial America, including the establishment of the final three of the original 13 American colonies. This is also likely when the colonial population grew to outnumber the natives. There were multiple nations with their eyes on the region, among them France and Spain, two superpowers we'd only recently clashed with. They may not have been under his direct area of instruction in terms of the colonies, but this was an era of colonial expansion, and you don't get a world empire by being nice. The incursions against both the Native Americans and French were very much under the purview of the British government. They were granting charters to the colonies out there, that sort of thing, and Newcastle in particular was the person in charge of that sort of thing as the Southern Secretary. And yet it was a huge surprise to Newcastle when a war kicked off there that then spread to just the whole of the rest of the world.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like he's paying much attention.
Hmm. So, what are you thinking in terms of prime and premiership?
It seems a bit mixed. I mean, does that initial quote that you gave of confused, bumbling, sometimes intelligent and knowledgeable, but maybe only because he has a huge amount of experience. I mean, I suppose after 24 years, you've got to pick up some of it. It's a bit flat.
Sort of fine.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
Yeah.
It is fine, but then, you know... He lost Menorca. He didn't see a war getting started. That's not good performance. Mm-hmm. Nothing really happens at home. There's not a huge amount of social reform, political reform, things that... Because, I mean, Henry Pelham, there are a couple of things that were genuinely good for people.
Mm-hmm.
None of that.
No. But then didn't we give Wilmington, like, 4, 4.5 here?
I think we did. I think we leaned towards the middle, but slightly below, on the basis that he did very little.
Right. I think this guy... Do we think he's maybe better than Lord Wilmington?
I might be going a touch worse.
Okay.
I
mean,
I don't know. I mean, I have to say, they did then start winning the war. And on the basis that it's not like they didn't know that war was an option. You know, it's not like he went, oh my God, a war happened. It just didn't happen where he was expecting it. And this sort of expansion where you're being very aggressive, it's going to lead to conflict.
Yeah, of course.
So it may be that he was essentially saying, well, we'll win if the conflict happens, you know.
And also, we love being at war with the French, right?
We did miss it.
Yeah.
It had stopped for a while, hadn't it?
I think he's better than Wilmington.
He's not great, but I think he's a little bit above okay.
Okay.
You can vote how you want.
Yeah. Okay, I've got a number.
Yeah.
I'm going to give him a 6.
Interesting. I'm going to give him, I think, 4.5.
And I'm going to give him a 5.5.
That's a total of 16 points for Prime and Premiership.
Life and Legacy.
Can we talk about the elephant in the room?
What?
I mean, come on. There's one thing that is his legacy.
What, that poo?
The poo!
I'm going to be honest, I have a much bigger legacy for him that you're not going to enjoy.
Oh, no.
But we'll get to that in a minute. First up, though, was one of the... you know what? The poo happened during his premiership. I'm afraid it's you've already had your chance
no!
to judge it.
No!
John,
I
can we go back?
It for legacy.
unless you're going to put it in sin and since. No, you know what? If you want to dock him legacy points because he is renowned for having done a poo during the coronation,
of course
that's
I do.
The sort of thing that gets turned up every time there's a coronation, so it's definitely in his legacy.
Oh my God, okay. Yeah, of course it's going in his legacy. I'm kidding.
So, Newcastle was one of the three main investors in George Frederick Handel's new opera company, the Royal Academy of Music.
Oh, okay, that's nice.
I like that. I like Handel.
He was also the Chancellor of the University of Cambridge.
Okay.
Just a bit of a ceremonial position, I think. Something that we mentioned that we might bring up, we might put this in the other category, but we've not really had this before. He married his wife when he was 23 and she was 16.
Yes, I remember that from the first episode and I was a bit like, ew.
That's definitely within the standards of the time, but we're judging him with
modern standards.
Now, and we go,
age of consent then is not,
In terms of his life, he lived in the shadow of his brother for a very long time. And when his brother was in charge, he actually said, everything as far as possible should first be talked over by you and me,
which is a bit of an admission that he felt that he was in second place and that he wanted more control, but he also knew that he couldn't really push for it.
This is bizarre because he's the older brother and he has all the stuff.
I know, it's so weird, isn't it?
Isn't it?
And yet his brother would sort out his finances for basically his entire life.
That must have been so annoying for Henry. Imagine. Yeah. You're like, oh, help me move my $5,000 billion.
Well, the annoying thing is that Henry was probably too honest to take a cut for it.
Yeah, he was, wasn't he?
Although I suppose his brother was bankrolling him in terms of his electoral expenses.
True, yeah, that's a good point.
But then his brother was only doing that because he had all the money.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not only that he feels he has to give decisions to Henry, he sort of wants to. He feels that he needs him.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is an admission of his own shortcomings, but they are shortcomings.
One big part of his legacy is his almost 24-year tenure as Secretary of State for the Southern Department.
Mm-hmm.
This makes him the longest-serving holder of any of the great offices of state that we will cover in the period of our podcast.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Mm. He served longer than any Secretary of State for either department, or Home Secretary, or Foreign Secretary, or Prime Minister.
Even than Robert Walpole?
Well, yes, because Robert Walpole was only Prime Minister for, what, 21 years?
2021, yeah.
He's beat Robert Walpole. I mean, who saw that coming?
Mm. As Secretary of State for the Southern Department. Sure, but still. Nobody else has been even close to his 24 years in his great office.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah.
However, with great power comes great responsibility. And that means that a bit of his legacy is the intercontinental slave trade.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true.
I couldn't find anything direct about his involvement in this, other than the fact that he lost money on South Sea Company. But in 1747, Liverpool overtook Bristol as Britain's busiest slave trading port. As Southern Secretary, the Duke of Newcastle was the minister who was responsible for the colonies. And while it seems a bit harsh to drop the entire transatlantic slave trade on his shoulders, the longest serving holder of that post was more than a little bit responsible.
Mm.
Yeah.
And unlike, say, Walpole and Pelham, it must have crossed his desk on a regular basis. So I'm really inclined to judge him quite harshly for that.
We should also judge him for what was going on in America at the time, right? I mean, you know, the appalling treatment of the Native American peoples
at
the hands of the British and all the other colonizers over there. I mean, this is presumably coming from his orders, I suppose. I mean, not directly, but, you know, he's the kind of guy at the top of the chain there.
And as you say, it was growing as well. So it's not only that the previous people had still a lot of involvement, but maybe slightly more detached involvement. It's growing under his watch as he was Southern Secretary for so many years.
Hmm. So how are people feeling?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of negative legacy.
Yeah, it's bad. Do we think it's worse than Robert Walpole? I think it might be.
No matter how much we didn't like his involvement with the South Sea Company, we didn't like the fact that he was so big on bribery.
He was brought up by other stuff. So I think I remember giving him like 3.5 or something for this. Mm.
We were not nice to him, yeah. But we did accept that he did have some legacy. Overall, he got 6.7. So we each gave him about 3.5.
Yeah, I think we have to be harsher.
Yeah, I think you're right. And especially, I mean, because of the positive legacy, like Walpole, one of the big things was the office of Prime Minister. I mean, that's a huge legacy that he had, and we're going to mark him highly for that. That pushed him up a bit, whereas Newcastle doesn't have that.
On the positive side, he was involved in winning a war, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was sort of started under the extension of his orders and led to the rise of the British Empire. I'm really struggling here.
No, I know. And it's an interesting one to mark. Your national power is sort of a good thing that you feel that if you're rating leaders, and many podcasts like this do give plus points for gaining territory, but that doesn't mean that bad things don't come with it.
Mm. All right. I think I'm ready.
I think I'm going to give him 2.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe 2.5.
I was going to go 2.5.
I'll go up to 2.5 because I was going between 2 and 2.5. I thought, yeah.
Actually, I'm going to go down.
Are you? Oh, we're going to swap.
If we're going between 0 and 5 as being the sort of bad zone,
that's a good point.
We're currently putting him halfway down it. And actually, I think maybe I'm going to go down to 1.5.
Because
there are some positive things in there, but he does represent a really not very nice era of British politics. I mean, during this period, also the Whigs were essentially destroying the Tories. He was, like all of his predecessors, spending vast amounts of money on buying elections. And it's more of the same. It's more of the let's make everything depressing, really, in terms of politics being so set in stone and that sort of thing. And he had the opportunity to make it better and he made it worse.
Yeah, just everything's grubby, isn't it? Maybe pulling us all down. I might go down to 2.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm going to stick with 2 then in that case.
All right. That gives him 3.7 for life and legacy.
Ooh, is that the lowest?
That is the lowest. Next up.
Sin and sincerity.
Newcastle was involved in the prosecution of Admiral Byng, the British admiral in charge of the relief force sent to aid Minorca when it was under attack from the French.
Oh, the rubbish one.
The fleet that just turned up and watched.
Yeah. Oh, Byng.
This was in the opening days of the Seven Years' War, and Byng left without even engaging the enemy. You may remember that I said that heads were going to roll and Newcastle quit.
Wait a second. Is this the admiral who ended up getting executed for just not being good enough? You mentioned in, like, episode one?
In Henry Pelham's episode.
Ah, oh, this is him.
Byng was executed by firing squad.
Wow.
Oh, firing squad.
So, a delegation from the City of London came to Newcastle complaining about Byng, and Newcastle said, he shall be hanged directly.
Oh.
Oh.
Newcastle resigned not long after, but Byng was executed by firing squad. Now, this partly happened because of the recent professionalisation of the Royal Navy. So you may remember in Henry Pelham's episode, as you said, that he reorganised the Navy a bit, and he was trying to cut down on political interference in the Navy by being very clear about what the consequences were for various offences. Well, Admiral Byng was successfully tried under the 12th Article of War for not doing his utmost.
Oh, God.
that's pretty vague.
And found guilty. Well, the new rules were very explicit in demanding death as the only consequence of that.
Oh, my God. God, that's a bit extreme, isn't it?
Very tough.
You know, and they're like, always do your best. Always do your best, or we will literally kill you.
Yes, England expects that every man will do his duty or be executed. So the judges presiding over the case recommended clemency, which they weren't legally supposed to do. William Pitt did the same. Newcastle did not.
Oh, no.
And Byng was executed.
Do we have any sense of, like, why?
One possibility is that Newcastle didn't feel that it made any difference either way. That, you know, he was going to go down. But it
made a difference to Byng.
Well, absolutely. Newcastle himself was also on the hook for this.
Maybe he
felt that Byng was a convenient scapegoat.
Ooh.
Or maybe he was incensed that Byng hadn't done anything. I mean, I literally sent you to do this job and you didn't do it.
Yeah.
Having somebody killed for that is a bit
much.
Yeah,
that seems extreme. But, I don't know, we've all been there, you know, long day at work.
Newcastle was also there when they wrote these rules.
Either way, whether or not he was a scapegoat or whether or not he should have done his job better, it sounds like if the judges and Pitt, the guy who came in to prosecute the war and therefore presumably oversee the military to some extent, are both saying, let's just let this guy off, and political interference from Newcastle results in an execution of someone. That's
a bit dodgy.
That is a bit dodgy. Real sort of political interference in judicial processes.
Pretty much everybody at the time thought this was appalling. And since, it's actually a bit of a bad chapter in British military history that's gone down as this is not okay. Right. You can't just execute people for not being good enough. In Candide, Voltaire said that in England it is considered a good thing to kill an admiral from time to time pour encourager les autres.
Is that where we get that phrase from? We do sometimes talk about people, you know, being really hung out to dry, pour encourager les autres. That is a phrase that we use. Interesting.
Ooh.
Comes from Voltaire's description of Byng.
Moving on, though. According to Newcastle, a Duke Without Money.
Half of the title of which is correct, the other half is incorrect.
Well, Newcastle had a lavish income from his estates and his offices, although he apparently never abused his office for the sake of self-enrichment.
Didn't really need to, though, did he?
Well, actually,
I suppose he did, yeah, because of all the election expenses.
He consistently spent more than he earned.
How is this possible?
And the single factor that consumed all others was his political campaigning.
I mean, this guy.
This drove him to the point of having to form a trust to handle his estate, which is literally the rich version of bankruptcy.
Oh.
Yeah.
He bankrupted himself by bribing people to vote for the Whigs.
How much of England did he own?
I mean, I don't know how much, but he was one of the richest landowners in the country in terms of land ownership.
This is ridiculous.
And it wasn't just his money he was spending. As Prime Minister, he was in charge of the Secret Service money, which is basically the government's slush fund. In the words of Louis Napier, legends naturally surround all the Secret Service. Its very name inspires fear and distrust and stimulates men's imagination. It is believed to be wise and wicked, efficient and powerful. In reality, the most common characteristic of political secret service at all times is its stupidity and the unconscionable waste of money which it entails.
Are we talking about spies here, the secret service?
So it's a bit of a precursor to that, but yes, we're talking about slush fund money, which could be used to fund agents overseas. It could be used to fund informants here or elsewhere. It could also be used to bribe individual MPs to vote your way or to pay constituents in an election. One of the things that comes up a lot when you're looking at boroughs that were under the control of individuals is how many of them were actually under government control, because the government had an interest in the region because they had a lot of sort of customs officers there or something. They could just control it, and this would be one of the means for doing that. So he was spending a lot of government money on bribing people and that kind of thing as well.
Can't believe he spent all his money and he still didn't go to space.
Yes.
So, he spent literally like the entire economy of a small country.
Yeah.
Just on bribing people. That's just poor management.
It is.
Well, Napier pointed out that given that 90% of the bribery of the era happened in the light of day, it was quite silly for the government to bother with it being secret at all.
That's true.
But there's no indication that Newcastle was particularly worse than his predecessors for doing this. In fact, Napier believed that Newcastle never had the need to bribe MPs directly for votes. But it says a lot when one of the richest people in the country is using the government slush fund and still bankrupting himself from all of the bribery that he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, this is ludicrous.
Quite incredible.
So what are we thinking for sin and sincerity?
Is it a sin to take a poo in the Queen's toilet? Yeah.
That one thing is causing a lot of points, isn't it?
I'm obsessed with this theory.
Majority. How big was the poo?
It took up most of the close stool.
I noticed that you haven't said much about the sincerity part of the title.
I did say that he didn't self-enrich from his offices.
Well, he didn't need to. He's one of the richest men in the country. He had all the titles. He couldn't get any more stuff.
It just feels like there's very little to go on.
Yeah.
So I suppose if I wanted to go into his integrity, the one other thing that I'd point to is when he essentially let Bing take the chop.
Yeah,
instead
I don't
of
like
him.
The execution. Yeah,
and that's, in fact, I agree, he got a bit of a golden payout at that stage, which we're going to go into in a minute.
Oh. All right. So it's insincere.
I really don't like the Bing thing.
Pretty much everything I read said that he was an honest and straightforward person in the sense that he wasn't scurrilous. When Horace Walpole described him as being without intrigue, he was right.
He wasn't the Robert Walpole of the era.
No, exactly.
He sounds like he was a bit too thick to scheme.
Potentially.
Because he was just... How did he spend so much? I just can't get over this. What was he doing? Just bribing people really badly?
I think maybe you're right. Maybe it's that he was thick and that's kind of funny, but not necessarily bad.
Oh.
Yeah, unless you do bad things like
someone
killing
executed,
an admiral.
Yeah,
I suppose so.
It's not dastardly and scheming, but it's still bad.
Yeah, and vast amounts of bribery. I know it was the time, but this is one of our enlightened rounds, and bankrupting yourself, even though you're astonishingly rich, by bribing people, that's also bad.
That seems pretty bad.
I'm sort of feeling something like 2.5 again.
I'm thinking I might give him a 4.
Oh, okay.
He was a bit of a buffoon. He wasn't plotting so much as he was just spending money.
Yes, but spending money on bad stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to go 3 because I'm taking him down a point for all the bribery, and then I'm taking him down a whole other point for Bing.
Yeah, I think that seems fair.
Yeah, I think I might join you there, actually. I think 3 is fair for the Bing.
Okay. The Bing thing.
So that's 5.7 points for sin and sincerity.
Also not great.
However, he's going to pick up some more points in the next round.
Majority.
His largest majority was 334 out of 558.
My God.
How?
It's not that he had 334 seats. It's that he had 334 seats more than everybody else.
Oh my God.
That is just vast.
That is astounding. How many of them did he buy?
Oh, loads.
Oh, why he was so bankrupt.
Personally, I think he's only supposed to have owned about 8 or 9 seats, but he just...
Yeah.
He campaigned heavily.
Yeah, and all the people he was related to owned lots of the others as well.
And then he just bribed everyone else.
Yeah.
There was also a big thing in this period that people stopped calling themselves Tories.
Yeah, I was about to say, basically a one-party state. Because if the Tories are the anti-Hanoverians...
They're wild, I didn't know about this.
Yeah, it's something we're going to get into in a little bit because there's a point at which the high majorities sort of fall off because there's too much infighting, basically.
Yeah. And then it becomes so far away from the Hanoverian succession that people start to be going, I'm a Tory. And people go, okay, fine, I don't care.
Mm. No, but
it's just such a sort of tainted thing still. Yeah.
You never actually want to win in being bigger than the other party because suddenly there's nobody else to fight anymore. And you don't have anybody holding you to account, and there's no opportunity for anybody to disagree with you, and you've suddenly become authoritarian.
Yeah. I mean, we've had the whole opposition Whig thing. I mean, it's you're the opposition, but oh, I'm not a Tory. I'm still a Whig, don't worry. I just hate all the Whigs.
So he's getting a 10.
He's getting a 10. Yeah. Seconds, yeah. Tenure. Across his two premierships, he was Prime Minister for 6 years, 18 months and 24 days. For a total of 2,765 days.
Okay, that seems average.
Actually, that's really high.
Is it?
8 points.
Is it?
8 points?
Yeah, because there are a couple of people who got like 10 or more years, but almost everyone is in the sort of 3 to 5 years.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I guess one premiership, yeah.
Prestige points.
First up, peerage.
Nothing.
Over the course of his life, Newcastle was variously made Baron Pelham, Viscount Pelham of Horton and Earl of Clare, which was after the town and family of Clare in Suffolk, which is the same Clare of Clare College, Cambridge.
Oh.
Where he went.
He went, yep. Mm-hmm. Then he was created Marquess of Clare and Duke of Newcastle upon Tyne. It was after this that he became Prime Minister, though, so he doesn't get any points for it.
No.
But he was also given the Garter, so he gets 1 point for that.
Yep.
And
ooh.
He was also given something as a thank you for his service as Prime Minister, Kess. Any guesses as to what it was?
Don't say a better toilet.
Did he become Lord of the Bathroom? Lord Privy Seal, Lord...
He was made Lord Privy Seal at one point.
What do you give the man who has everything?
Oh, what do you... A gift card to John Lewis. I don't know. What do you give
That would have blown his mind.
Rob, Hot do you tub. Know what he was given or made?
I cannot imagine what he was made.
He was made Duke of Newcastle under Lyme.
What?
He was Duke of Newcastle upon Tyne.
No!
So they made him Duke of the other place called Newcastle.
He's Duke of two different Newcastles at the same time.
Wait, but he doesn't get any points for
he
that.
He doesn't get any points for that because already he's already a Duke.
That's great.
Oh,
I'm Duke of two different Newcastles.
Two Newcastles.
I love the idea that he's circled. He's got a map of Britain and he's circled every place called Newcastle. And he just wants one by one.
If you live in Newcastle in the States, which I'm sure there are many of, do write in and let us know if Duke Newcastle.
If you're from Newcastle upon Tyne or Newcastle under Lyme, write in. And whichever one of you writes in the most is the better Newcastle.
So his previous title was remaindered to heirs male. Rob?
The remainder to a peerage is the people who can inherit it. So if it is remaindered to your heirs male, it is remaindered to all of your male line descendants.
Which he didn't have any of.
Oh.
So when he first resigned, he was given a special peerage.
The second Duke of Newcastle. Sorry, the first Duke of the second Newcastle. Okay, Newcastle under line.
Yes, yeah. Which was specially remaindered to be inherited by... his nephew, Henry Fiennes Pelham Clinton.
Oh, triple-barreled.
Henry Fiennes Pelham Clinton.
Yeah, I think Fiennes is a middle name. Burke's Peerage lists him as being Henry Fiennes Clinton. But Burke's Peerage is also super snooty about people's names. It actually refers to Thomas Hollis Pelham because it thinks that Pelham is the better name somehow.
Oh, that's so confusing.
Hollis is the better name somehow,
yeah.
So basically, when they gave him that peerage, it seems like they thought, he's quite old, he doesn't have any sons, so... we're going to create this dukedom to be inheritable to, like, random nephews and things that he has just so the title won't die or won't die as easily.
Did he have any female descendants?
No, he and his wife did not, unfortunately, have any children after an early miscarriage.
Mm.
So, yes, he only gets 1 point for peerage.
For having the Garter.
Despite having literally everything and the top thing twice.
He peaked too early.
Oh, he did. How many people have had 6 titles at the same time?
That's a good question.
Oh, I think there were more than 6. There were other ones that I just didn't even go into. God. I think he was given another barony at some point.
Oh my god.
He'd lose track after a while, wouldn't you?
Progress. Newcastle was aristocracy born and bred, and he went to Westminster School and Clare College, Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
No points.
Yeah.
Practice. As well as being First Lord of the Treasury, Newcastle was also Northern and Southern Secretaries.
One of them for a very long time.
So he gets 1.5 points in total.
Very good. Just missing Chancellor of the Exchequer, and we'd already got to a point where that probably wasn't going to be given to a Lord.
He was also Lord Privy Seal, which is one of the great officers of
state. Ah, is he our first great officer of state, or has someone else been?
He is not. We have had Lord Wilmington.
Of course.
Parlance. Newcastle was neither gallant, nor reverend, nor learned.
Oh dear. No.
He was noble, but we aren't counting it if you're in the Lords.
Yeah.
Which is a bit weird, but basically...
I'm fine with it.
We're much more interested in the edge case where you were somehow noble in the Commons than we're giving you a point for being a Lord, because being a Lord is something that you already get points for.
Yeah, fair enough.
Polling.
No.
No.
He paid for many an election.
Yes.
But he never stood in one himself.
Oh, he would have been so mad that he spent his entire fortune buying elections and he's not getting any points for
You're
it.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
That's what he deserves.
So how do you think we're doing?
Oh, I don't know. Worse than Bath? Surely not.
We've given him, he's got tenure, which Bath didn't have, and he's got a big majority, which Bath didn't have.
Oh, yeah, true. That's two, like, 10 points, isn't it?
Actually, to be fair, he got 18 points for those two things, which is precisely what Bath got for his entire life.
Yes, it actually wasn't possible for him to do worse than Bath.
So
he's worse than Walpole, for sure.
Below average. I'm thinking maybe just below average. 40-something.
45.8.
You're very good at this. I can never gauge it. I just don't keep track of the maths.
Just behind Lord Wilmington with 46.2.
Oh,
so he did worse than Lord Wilmington.
Oh, yeah.
But then Lord Wilmington was so boring that we just had to give him 5.
Yeah, that's true.
But the scores aren't everything.
Right on or right off?
So the case four.
Yes, do give us that.
He definitely threw an admiral under the bus.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I have quite a strong case four, I think.
Oh, yeah? I'm sorry, Cassie. I think this is going to be a crap case.
Surely.
It says a lot if the single thing that might make you go down in history is something you left behind.
Shit on. All right.
Oh, I'm going to have to believe that.
That's so good.
Okay, poos aside, I'm not totally convinced. John, do you have anything to really add to Kess's suggestion?
I don't think we can give it to him.
No, sorry. He's a bit below average and not even in a fun way.
Just a bit rubbish. He got all the stuff and he had all the money and then he was just so disappointing.
Yeah, he was a bit. Yeah, no, it's a no.
Yeah, I think the no's have it.
And that brings us to...
Dispatch Box.
Following our division episode, a couple of our lovely listeners have pointed out that the BBC published an article about the decline of division bells in establishments near Westminster, including the Red Lion Pub, the famous Red Lion Pub. So yeah, we've been saying that there are bells all over the estates that call you to a vote, and there have also been bells in various pubs, clubs and restaurants within an 8-minute walk, but they are sadly in a bit of a decline.
And we might have a listener at the BBC who decided to write an article on the basis of having listened to our podcast. maybe.
Maybe, if that's true, because it did come out, you know.
Straight afterwards,
If that's you, write in. I'm gutted about this.
Yeah.
I was really, when you told me this, I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah, it's annoyingly, it's the sort of the phone changes that are happening at the moment, because it does require a physical cable connection, a physical telephone line to be connected from the Palace of Westminster to your establishment, and they are quite costly and hard to get, and especially now in the modern day, MPs all have phones and the whips just send you a text saying, come on.
Couldn't they just send the pub a text and the pub could ring the bell?
Oh, that'd be quite cute.
Yeah,
that'd be nice. Let's try to get that going. But there are still bells all over the actual parliamentary estate, but just not as much in the pubs.
I think it's possible to get a digital feed from Parliament. I mean, for one thing, there is just parliamentary TV. So if you wanted it, you probably could set up a modern day division bell system that uses sort of internet thing. But yeah, it's just the fact that the whips are always going to text all of the members and say, get to Parliament now and vote for this. So it's just
not needed as much.
Yes, and in British politics, we never do anything that's not needed just because it's tradition.
I quite like the idea of the sort of, you know, call of democracy being something that's heard across the 8-minute circle around.
No, I think it's nice. I think it's sad that it's going.
Although that does remind me that there is one thing that we do still do, which is I think when there are votes, when there are debates late in the night, there's a light on top of the Elizabeth Tower, also known as Big Ben, because of the bell inside it. There's a specific light that's only on, I think, when there are debates on.
Yes, I think when either house sits during the hours of darkness, there's like a big spotlight on top of Big Ben that's lit.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, but like a sort of bat signal, but for politics.
The story is that you can see it from like the upper rooms of Buckingham Palace, and like Queen Victoria wanted to see when Parliament was sitting or something, so they just installed a light. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's the story.
Well, thank you very much to Kathy and Andrew, who wrote in to us about that.
Promo. Do you like Vikings? Do you like medieval history? Do you like Iceland? Do you like complex, sometimes generational feuds fueled by the honor culture of a small-scale society in the medieval North? Well, if your answer to any of these questions is yes, you'll want to join us for Saga Thing, a podcast where we review the sagas of medieval Iceland. Now, for over a decade, we have been telling the stories of Iceland's first settlers and their families. And their feuds over sheep. And in each episode, we break down a different saga, unraveling its intricate plot, discussing the characters, and providing historical context to transport you back to a time of warriors, kings, and incredible feats of both martial and legal prowess.
And don't worry if you're new to the world of the sagas. We're here to make it accessible and entertaining for everyone.
And when we're done reviewing each saga, we take it to the Saga Thing, where we provide an official body count and judge the saga for things like best bloodshed, nicknames, and notable witticisms.
We weigh the actions of the heroes and villains, sending one into exile and welcoming the other into our esteemed Halls of Thingmen.
So, if you like medieval stuff and want to know more about what Vikings did when they were at home,
grab a hornful of mead and join us. Check out Saga Thing.
So that was a promo for Saga Thing. Saga Thing is such a good podcast. I'm obsessed with Saga Thing. They're so fun. They go through all of the Viking sagas and they effectively just break them down, tell you the story. And then as they go along, they discuss some of the historical implications of this and some of the like literary and social implications of it. And it's just really interesting. And I knew absolutely bugger all about Saga. I literally never heard of a saga when I first went into this. And it was so interesting looking at how they overlap and how they interweave, because there seems to be this kind of generally accepted mythology, and so characters that will turn up in one saga will turn up as like a small sort of side character in a different saga, and like you know, there'll be sort of people who turn up again and again, conventions that turn up again and again. It's really, John and Andy do a really good job of just making them really kind of engaging and accessible and quite interesting and fun, and they do silly voices for the characters, and I really enjoy that as well. I'd really recommend them. I really enjoy them.
Awesome. Oh, fantastic. Yeah, take a listen.
This was Thomas Pelham Hollis, first Duke of Newcastle upon Tyne and first Duke of Newcastle under Lyme.
And Marquess of Duke of
and the Baron five times.
Of Clare and we'll be back next time with the Duke of Devonshire. Thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at primetime_cast, or you can write in to writeonwriteoff@gmail.com. Please do write in if you're from any of the places we've mentioned, all of the Newcastles. If you want to find out more about any of the texts we sourced in this episode, you can go to primetimepod.com to find our episode notes.
And remember, never flinch, never weary, never despair, and subscribe to our podcast.
I can't believe you forgot about Lord Wilmington, Rob. He was
you and everyone
so
else.
Memorable.
Me and his entire cabinet.
So true.
Wilmington. Oh, that name rings a bell. Someone's...
Meanwhile, he's just dead in the corner.
That meme with the skeleton at the bottom of the...
Oh, yeah.
Do you like Vikings?
I do.
Do you like medieval history?
Yes.
Like Iceland?
Yes.
No.
Like complex, sometimes generational feuds.
No.
Yes.
By the honor culture of a small-scale society in the medieval North.
Weirdly specific.